Welcome to another episode of Thinking Like a Bank, where we show you how to think like a bank by applying the same strategies and principles that banks use to help you find more financial freedom in your life. I'm your host, Sari Ibrahim. Today, I'm interviewing Billy Keels, a strategic advisor at First Generation Capital Partners and the host of the Going Long podcast. Billy helps high-wage earners escape the corporate rat race by discovering passive income opportunities so they can stop trading time for money. Although Billy is not a tax professional, the investment strategies he shares can help high-wage W-2 earners reduce some of their income taxes. Check out this episode to learn more about how you can reduce your W-2 taxes by investing passively. Billy, welcome to our podcast.
Sari, thanks so much, man. I am looking forward to a fantastic conversation. Hopefully, we'll be able to add a little bit of value by the time you and I have finished.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. I've been following you for a while on LinkedIn, and I like your content. I like the kind of the message you are sharing with audience, like kind of transitioning from the corporate life to being self-employed to having multiple streams of passive income. I think that's really interesting. But before we jump into that, I want to know more about you and your background.
Yeah, cool. And I know I'm a guest on the podcast, Sari, but would you mind if I did just made one really quick request?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So listen, everybody, if you are a guest or you are not a guest, but you're a listener of the podcast and you've been listening or watching for quite a long time and you still have not left Sari that honest written review as well as rating, now is your time. Make sure that you leave him a nice, honest written review as well as a rating on your favorite podcast platform, because it really helps him to attract guests that can help you to get exactly what it is that you want. So make sure you just take a couple seconds. It's really, really simple to leave that 5-star review as well as rating. So, yeah, sure. No problem, Sari. So with that as a background, I think the best way to describe me is I'm a very, you know what it's like to come from a middle-class family where you watch your parents sometimes struggle to make ends meet. At the end of the month, they had to make really tough decisions in terms of the things that they were going to pay, which types of bills they were going to pay. So I grew up watching that financial stress. So I had a really negative relationship with money because my parents had a negative relationship with money. Also, we moved around different states. I was born in Ohio. We lived in Colorado and Texas. I watched my parents get into a lot of marital strife that eventually led to them getting divorced when we moved back to Ohio. So I'm a product of a divorced home. From there, you know what? I was really focused on doing what my parents told me to do. Like, they didn't want me to have to work as hard as they did. So they said, you're going to have to go out and you're going to get a job. You're going to study really, really hard. You're going to get good grades and you're going to get a great job. And that's what I did. To the point that I have 2 degrees. I've got 2 degrees from Miami University in the southwest of Ohio. I also thought I was going to get my dream job. And Sari, you know what? Because I had 2 degrees, I lived overseas one time and came back. But not only did I get rejected from my dream job, which is to be in a brand role at a big company called P&G, I got rejected once and twice. And so that was really hard to like deal with rejection, because I was someone who usually got really good grades. I'm someone today that I consider myself to be a recovering perfectionist. And when I got rejected twice, the most amazing thing happened to me, because I have these amazing friends, and you start realizing in your deepest, darkest moments, like, who are the people that really care about you the most? Who are the ones that are really, truly there for you? And I have a really good friend of mine named Andy, who was from St. Louis, and he told me about these people that worked and traveled around the world. And so I applied for this role. There were about 6,000 people that applied for this role back in 1996. I was one of 26 people selected to do this work for this company called Meritz. And what this company did, it allowed me to work and travel throughout 58 different countries by the time I was 26. Wow. So when I think about being rejected from my dream job and not, you know, probably being stuck in a cubicle somewhere, through that rejection and having wonderful friends and relationships and them caring enough about me, I got to start to see the world. So much to the fact that by the time I was 26, I'd seen 58 countries. I'm a kid from Columbus, Ohio. I never thought I was going to see anything even west of California. So I decided that I wanted to do a one-year sabbatical. I got accepted at a university in Paris called the Sorbonne. I didn't know how to speak French language. I didn't know anything about the culture, but I went over there with 3 objectives. Learn French language and culture, learn how to salsa dance, learn more about wine. I did all those things. Awesome. At least I drank a lot of wine that helped my salsa, and I was also learning French. So let's say that I kind of did it that way. But I ended up moving to the south of France. I moved to a town called Montpellier. While I was there, I started working in the IT industry, high tech. I was there. They sent me to Italy to start up a sales team. So always focused on building teams, sales, and things like that. Ended up meeting a woman who was from Barcelona, Spain. She moved in July of 2005, or I moved to Spain in July of 2005. We got married in 2008, have two kids. And, you know, it was a fantastic, really, really fantastic life, right? And so one of the things that happened along the way, and then I'll kind of wrap up, is I kept working at multinationals this entire time. I was working in at Dell in on the high tech side of hardware. Mm-hmm. I then moved to work for a company called Computer Associates in software space. And then the last 16 years of my corporate career, I worked for a really big software company, enterprise software called SAP. Mm-hmm. I really liked my corporate role. I made way more money than I should have because I was really good at my job. I was in the top talent program. I was going to Hawaii every couple of years. And eventually I started investing in other things, but I'm sure we'll talk about that later. But one of the things that when I was investing so much, or when I was earning so much money through my day job, there was this constant pain that was happening to me, because it's like a lot of salespeople, Sari. I don't know about you, but even when you talk to a lot of people that go to Vegas, people tend to come back and they tell you about how much they made in Vegas. What they don't tell you is about all the money that they left along the way. And it's very similar. Like when you're a top earning sales person, like the company I used to work for before, like there was this company called RepView. RepView looks at the top producing salespeople, and the top producing salespeople back in 2019, they were earning $1.2 million, wow. Right? Everybody tells you that good part of the story, right? Because you're making $1.2 million. But if that $1.2 million income earner lived in California, the reality is they only kept $600,000. Definitely a first world problem, but it's only 50%. Doesn't feel so good. So anyway, so I started learning a lot along the way, and really had a great corporate career, eventually left corporate, and have since really been focusing on serving accredited investors, doing other types of syndication. I'm sure we can talk about that. But that's the kind of Reader's Digest version of this guy from Columbus, Ohio, who never thought he was going to go west of California. Since then, I've gone to 86 countries. I've been fortunate enough to travel to 86 countries. Since living in Europe, I've learned 4 new additional languages. Wow. And a father of 2. So
awesome. I mean, 86 countries, aren't there only like 200 countries in the world? So you've seen pretty much half the globe.
Yeah, I think like 210. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's awesome. And it's awesome how you went from like a traditional American life to a traditional European life, like living in different multiple European countries, which I'm sure is like kind of normal to do in Europe, right? To speak multiple languages, to live in multiple countries.
Yeah, I mean, you see a lot more of that happening, but even like here, I live in Spain, and I would say the majority of people, you know, just speak Spanish. Or yeah. I'd go to France, and the majority of people just speak French. And then you go to the more cosmopolitan cities, your Barcelona, your Paris, your Madrids, and people maybe mix a little bit more language. But yeah, living over here for such a long time has really helped to open my perspective on life and things like that. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, awesome. So let's get right into it. I'm really curious, like what type, if you don't mind sharing, like if you don't mind, can you share with us more about like the types of investments you're helping clients with?
Yeah. So, and maybe if I can even take a step back, like the reason that I even got into anything that was not the stock market, right? Because I grew up in a financially not wealthy home. We had very little to no financial education. And so what I did was follow the herd early on because when the HR person came in, they said, you know, are you ready for your retirement? Sign this box. I checked the box. And of course I was investing in the stock market, mm-hmm. or actually speculating in the stock market.
Yeah.
That worked for a couple of years. And then 2000 happened, dot-com bubble. I lost a lot of the value. I thought I lost the money, but I just lost the value of my portfolio. And my financial advisor said, don't worry, you know, do some DCA. I didn't even know what that meant. Dollar cost averaging, putting the same amount of money every month. And it's eventually going to come back. He was absolutely right. Not only did it come back, but it actually went even further than it was when I lost the money before. The only challenge was is 2008 was just around the corner. And so that point, I lost 33% of my portfolio. And so I was like, if something happens once, shame on them. If it happens twice, shame on me. So I eventually started looking at, I read this little purple book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, that a lot of people read. I started going down the whole podcast, listening, reading all the dad series books, and eventually got to a point where I said, hey, listen, I need to actually purchase some real estate. I thought I was going to do it here in Spain. It was cash flow negative. Long story short, I ended up buying my very first very small duplex back in New Jersey. And so I would definitely not, nothing against New Jersey, but I would never do that again. I actually liquidated, eventually sold everything I had in New Jersey because you start learning. As you have to get started somewhere, but eventually you start realizing what is your identity? What are you looking for? I've invested everything from smaller multifamilies. I own a mobile home park. And then along the way, I was someone who was an accredited investor, right? And so that accredited investor is someone who earns I don't know, you have a sophisticated audience, but just in case, you earn over $200,000 the previous 2 years, you're expected to do that this year, or you have $1 million in net worth. Sarah, you would be amazed the number of people that I speak to that are doctors, lawyers, high-end sales executives, and you ask about accredited investor status, and they don't even know about it. They don't even know how to qualify, if they have to qualify. And so it's one of these things that I always, even though I think most of us know, I like to just tell the people, tell people, like, hey, listen, this is what an accredited investor is. I didn't know what it was. So when I found out that I was an accredited investor, I had access to some very exclusive type of opportunities where I could actually have higher control, because I could actually meet the people that were doing the work or overseeing the work, not like the person who was at the 800 number at, pick your financial services advisor. It just became very different. So what I then started doing is I started giving my capital to other people, 200,000 here, 300,000 there. They would do the investment for me for things like ATM machines, or maybe large multifamily value add opportunities, or maybe there were other things like development projects, and I've got a couple hotels and things like that. So I started doing all this. And what I realized is that this was all helping me to achieve a goal, which was I really wanted to be able to have the option to leave corporate when I wanted to. And these were now creating passive streams of income. But the thing that happened was I was always expecting real estate specifically to do four things for me. Number one, I thought it was going to help me to have equity build up over time. So tenants pay off the mortgage and I start owning more of the property. I really understood early on, because part of your business plan is you can force appreciation. So you get like the forced appreciation, you kind of get the phased appreciation, you get appreciation just because of it happens. I also looked for cash flow, which was kicking off cash flow. And I also thought it was going to lower my income tax. I thought it was going to lower my income tax, but what people kept saying was that it was going to lower my taxes. And so when I was a really high wage earner and I was in these development projects or multifamily value added projects, like usually I wasn't getting my payments in the first year or the year and a half, because you have to execute the business plan. So the value add, you usually are going to get the tax benefits, but it's against very little to no income. And so what I realized is the tax part that I was misunderstanding, or I was hearing differently, it was actually helping me not pay so much tax, but it was because it was tax efficient, because the type of income that I was generating was IRS definition of passive income, not the income that you're not working for that is directly related to your time. Like, there's literally a definition of passive income in the IRS code. Like specifically, if you look in 469, I know you know this kind of stuff. They'll talk to you about passive activity losses and things like that. So when I realized that my real estate investing wasn't actually helping me keep more of my income tax, that's what led me to actually start looking into other sectors. Because one of my mentors told me is, if you want to get better answers, you have to ask better questions. Yeah. And so then I started asking the question, okay, well, look, how can I go about keeping more of my income tax? And it started then showing me certain investment vehicles that would allow me to do that, one of which was in the energy space. And so I began to also, in the latter part of my corporate career, start to invest in the energy space. And what I found in that for me, right, and my risk tolerance and my understanding, was that it was something that worked really well for me. Why? Because I got strong tax benefits up front, and then I got the return on my capital over time. And also, I know I didn't say this earlier, Barry, but, and sometimes that may be construed as like I'm giving people advice. I'm not giving anybody advice. Yeah. And I don't plan on doing that. I'm not a financial advisor. I have no ability to do that kind of stuff. When you ask me the question, I'm just telling you kind of what my journey has been, and kind of why some of the reasons that I've invested in different things and the things that I was actually looking for. So if you're listening to me, please know that I'm not giving you any kind of advice. I have no titles or certifications to be able to do that. I'm just sharing a little bit of my story.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for that. So it sounds like, and I agree, because I had the same kind of misunderstanding. I thought like if you just put like $50,000 into a real estate deal, then you can like wipe off $50,000 off like your income taxes. And that's not true. Typically, when it is true is when you're a real estate professional.
Exactly.
Or if you put like, for example, $50,000 into a real estate deal, and then you get back $50,000 through like the rental income or whatever income you get from that property, typically the money you're receiving back is like not tax-free, but I guess it's tax-favored or depreciated income that you're getting back. So that way it's not like direct income as if you are working a W-2 job or actively engaged in a business, there are tax, it's tax efficient. But I like how you then transition into energy where it is tax efficient upfront. So do you mind? So like in that same example, like you're a high paid work with a W-2 employee, let's just say software sales, you make $200,000 a year. You take $50,000 from your checking account, you put it into an energy deal with you. In that case, is that $50,000 like directly taking off your federal and state income taxes from your W-2 job?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. And so let me just reiterate one thing to everybody. So of course, I am not a CPA. Mm-hmm. I am not giving anybody any kind of tax advice. What I can tell you is, and I'll even, let me go back to a previous year, right? Because this is stuff that has happened in the past. It has nothing to do with what we're doing today or potentially do in the future. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when the bonus depreciation rules were 100%, right? Because we are in a specific sector of energy, there are some very specific guidelines in the Internal Revenue Code. So the IRS and the tax code has very specific guidelines for energy production, very concretely oil and gas production. And so if we go back to 2022, when the bonus depreciation rules were 100%, so if you invested 100% of something, you made the investment, then you were able to write off, as long as that asset was a depreciable asset and you mm-hmm. could use the IRS code 168K specifically against that, then you could take that entire loss in year one, right? So one of the things that you would do, and I'm just going to change the numbers a little bit. So let's say that you invested $100,000 back in 2022, and you were also applying a loan, and that loan gave you 50% loan to value. So you bring in $100,000, you then get a fully recourseable loan, which is another $100,000. So your total actually is $200,000, right? And let's say you're someone who lives in Chicago and you're a really high wage earner, and between state and federal, we're just going to make this up. You owe 40%. It's probably going to be a little bit higher than that, but you're in the 40% tax bracket. So you have invested in this project. You've invested $100,000. You've taken out a $100,000 loan. We're back in 2022 where you still had 100% bonus depreciation. So that $200,000 that you have, you then take that more or less, and you would multiply that times your 40% tax bracket. Well, right up front, that $200,000 of loss times your 40% tax bracket, that would actually generate for you $80,000 in this fictitious example, $80,000 loss against your W-2 income, which is money that you have either prepaid and would get back, or money that you should pay and you, because you've made this, you've taken the risk of investing in a specific area of energy, you got the reward of being able to take the loss against your ordinary income. Think W-2.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. And the loan you mentioned, what kind of loan is that?
Yeah. So this type of loan in particular would be a fully recourseable loan. So having a personal guarantee against the loan.
So we're applying leverage to increase tax savings, which is a very common thing to do in real estate and other investments. It's where you're borrowing money to, I guess, increase your losses in essence.
Well, yeah. And then there's another thing to think about that though, right? Because I always like to think about it from the other way. Like, it's really, anytime you add leverage, right, Terry, more leverage comes with responsibility, because that's also more risk. Imagine you take out a mortgage on your home, but you're not able to repay the mortgage on your home. Well, what are they going to do? They're going to repossess your home, or they're going to come after you. So I always like to temper it by saying, don't just think about the benefit, think about the risk. And so how are you evaluating the risk of being able to repay that loan? If you've evaluated that and you feel comfortable with it, then okay, great. You're going to be able to increase the potential tax benefit, but you're also going to have to repay that. So that's something that you're also going to have to be aware of, and you don't get something for nothing. I say this all the time, even on my own podcast, is you have to be aware of if you're going to get a risk or you're going to get reward, it's probably because you've taken some risk somewhere, and understand what that is.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I love how you mentioned that, like something for nothing, like you have to, there are things you have to give up, some risk you have to take on in order to get to that next level. And it actually makes a success more realistic that way, instead of just thinking, well, if I just do these two things, then it'll be like free money. And that's not the case. Like in this situation here, you're personally guaranteeing a loan, and maybe even there's assets involved in that, and then you have to pay back the loan with interest. So what if the investment you're investing into doesn't work out? And this is why, like, you have to be an accredited investor, right? So that way it shows that you understand how these investments work. And it shows also that when somebody invests like $100,000 into these deals, they're not investing 100% of their liquid cash or liquid assets. They're investing maybe 20% or 30% or maybe 40% of their liquid assets into these types of investments. So that way they could handle that type of risk and waiting period to get their money back, right?
Yep. That's exactly it. Yeah. I mean, you would, which is why in Sari, I know you know this, right? As you tell people, it's your investable capital. It's not your available capital. It's your investable capital. Mm-hmm. And so, because you always want to go into it with the mindset that, hey, listen, I'm putting it here and I may never, ever, ever get this back.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe not.
And it's worth, I guess the mindset is also worth it too, because if, let's just say you do nothing at all, like you never invest, you just have your W-2 job and then you just stack up a bunch of cash. The problem with that is there's inflation involved, right? And then there's loss of opportunity costs and then taxes. Yep. So it's still worth it taking the, if you are an accredited investor, you do have knowledge about these things, you did consult with your accountant and lawyer, you know, it's worth it to pursue these types of investments. Now, but I want to kind of transition more into like, so like you invest into a capital group, right? That's managing energy investments or investments related to energy. What exactly is kind of happening in the background? Like, where is that money going? What's being bought? What's being sold? Like, how is their value being added?
Yeah, great. Yeah. Love this question, Sari. So basically what we're doing is we're bringing together a limited partnership. So this is a syndication, right? We're bringing together 506C. So for exclusively for accredited investors, we are bringing capital together, right? After we spend time or invest time educating our investors. And ultimately, what we're doing is we are purchasing a piece of energy equipment. This piece of equipment, what it does is has an innovative ability to absorb CO2 on the front end. And then that is, it is absorbing CO2. So really helping with things that we're talking about now, like taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, the Paris Accord, all these kinds of things. We're absorbing CO2 into a gas and pipeline stream. We're then using that saturated liquid to then inject and be able to produce more oil and gas. So, and it's done in a way that's much cleaner than using water or something like that, for instance. So we're purchasing these large pieces of equipment. These pieces of equipment that are being purchased are depreciable equipment because we're in oil and gas. Once again, this goes back to what we were talking about before. We are in oil and gas production. We have a piece of machinery that is a depreciable asset. So we're able to use the tax code like 168K or, you know, 179, depending on who your tax person is. And once again, I'm not here to give any tax advice, but the use of the funds goes to purchase the piece of machinery. That piece of machinery is then managed by our operating partner, as well as the end users, who are very, very, very large energy companies who are looking to use these pieces of equipment because they have to always be producing energy. And this is a lower cost way of being able to produce more energy, oil and gas specifically. So does that answer your question?
Absolutely. Yeah, it makes sense. I see where like the root of the benefits are. It's the equipment, the depreciable equipment. That's where you get the tax benefits from. Yep. And then that's where, I guess, so then what happens then is that equipment increases in value over time and there's like an exit?
No, so just the opposite. So what happens is, so because we're helping these big energy companies produce more oil and gas, we are providing them with what I like to call it's a big red machine. And this big red machine has a blue barrel with it. And so these barrels, in using the machines and the barrels, that we're actually paid by these big companies for the use of these two things. So that's how our investors are actually making their money, because they're using these two the barrel and the big machine, and we're being paid for that. We get the depreciation because we're using a depreciable asset. So meaning that this asset is actually going to go down in value over time. So unlike real estate, where typically you'll get to a point where you're a value add plan, so you're selling the asset for more than it's worth when you bought it, then you can get into things like depreciation recapture. Mm-hmm. Here we don't have recapture because the actual value of the asset is worth less when we're finished with it. So for some people, it could be an added advantage.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, thank you so much for mentioning that, because with real estate, it's not just kind of like just all depreciated and then that's it. You completely wipe away that tax bill. It's like there's depreciation recapture and then you have to do like 1031 after that to kind of keep deferring the taxes. But in this situation, you don't have to, because the asset is actually not just a paper loss depreciation, but the value of it is actually going to go down Whereas real estate tends to do the opposite. It's a paper loss appreciation, but it goes up in value over time, usually.
Yeah. That's absolutely correct in terms of the value of the asset. The one thing I would say is because we're using bonus depreciation rules, at least in this example, right? We're going back to 2022. Yeah. We use the bonus depreciation rule. So remember, after the first year, you don't have any more tax shelter per se, because you've used it all in year one. So as the revenue comes back to you, you know, you do need to look for other ways to be able to offset that in the future. But it's still a great way to be able to, especially for W-2 workers. There are very few to no vehicles that will allow us the opportunity to generate a return, because it's very important also, too, in my opinion, to not have the tax dog wag the tail, but find something that can generate a return. And at the same time, if you're able to also add tax benefits, well, then you found something that kind of helps you get the best of both worlds.
Yeah. And for W-2 employees, it's not that common to find tax deductions and tax breaks. It's really like very limited, like, you know, maybe IRA, like $6,500, some interest you can write off if you do the standard deduction. So it's kind of like very limited as far as what you could deduct from W-2. So this is really important. It's really good. Now, when you're getting that income, is like, are you getting like monthly income or quarterly or annual? How does it kind of?
Yeah, typically it happens on a quarterly basis. Yep. There's a startup period. So let's say it's 7-9 months. And then at which point you'll get a first distribution, and that happens quarterly thereafter.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. And then as that income is coming to you, is that like limited partnership income?
Well, after the first year, then the income becomes, well, you would move from a general partner to a limited partner, but also the income, the tax treatment of the income, I think that's really more for your CPA to go into, because everybody's situation is different.
Oh, gotcha.
Typically the character of the income, once again, I'm not a CPA, I'm not giving anybody advice. Typically the character of the income would not change, but you know, I don't know if someone with their tax team has different, you know, different insights or different rulings and things like that, that they're in a much better position to say, you know, really how that would work thereafter.
As we're wrapping up, Billy, I wanted to kind of go a little bit further into, like, if you're comfortable answering this, what, like, if you can kind of look back at a previous case you've worked on, a previous investment for a client, like, they, what were some of the average internal rates of return or average kinds of ROI that, you know, one has seen or one projected could see? I know it's not guaranteed that, you know,
yeah,
they put X
no,
amount
yeah.
of dollars in.
Yeah, you know, more than that, let me give a different kind of example. So, because depending on where you are looking, I mean, you could be well above 40% in terms of the IRR, right? Okay. If you want to look at something like that, or if something that you've seen in the past. But I think really it's about what is the use case that someone is interested in doing, right? And a lot of times people want to invest more in real estate because real estate is a way to get more passive income. And when I say passive income, I mean the tax treatment on the income, meaning that if you earn between $0 and $41,000, I think is what it is, then that you have a 0% tax treatment. Mm-hmm. That's pretty awesome. If you're at 41,000 to 442,000, don't quote me on this, but more or less, then you're taxed at 15%. And then anything over 442,000, it's like only taxed at 20%. If you look at the same thing on the ordinary side, that ordinary income, it's 37% plus your federal plus whatever. I mean, it could get up to, we have investor family members that are in California. It's like 50%.
Yeah.
Insane. Yeah. So, you know, I think so a lot of this is really about what is the use case? So I'll come back to that person who wants to invest more in real estate, but they just don't have capital. There, you found out today you're an accredited investor and you're thinking, wow, you know what? This sounds like something that would be really cool. I've got $400,000 that's sitting in the bank doing nothing. Mm-hmm. Sari and I have talked about some ways that we can use it in some different type of life insurance products. They can help me and we can leverage this kind of stuff. Well, you know, I can actually take, let's say I take $200,000 out today, and we're going to go back to the example from last year where it was 100% bonus depreciation. That way it keeps everybody out of trouble. It was $200,000 you put in, you put leverage another $200,000. So you had $400,000. Yeah. dollars of accessible capital, and you're in a 40% tax bracket, right? You then take that times 40%. So you actually now have $160,000 based on this fictitious example that you can do something else with. So the question always for me is, what do you plan on doing with the capital that you are going to have at the end of this first period? Because in this case, this person would have $160,000. Is this something where they can say, hey, listen, I'm going to fund more of my whole life insurance plan is this, I want to get involved in two syndications plus my whole life insurance plan because I've got $160,000. So maybe there's two $50,000 syndications and then I'm going to do something else with the other X amount of money. Or do I want to finally make a really big bet and use all this extra capital to go $160,000 into something else? The question is, what do you plan on doing with the funds to get you closer to whatever your life goal, dream, or aspiration is? Because that's what really starts to make the difference. It's not just the fact that you're keeping more of your money up front, which is extremely important in my opinion. It's what do you do just after that? That's the thing that makes the difference.
God, yeah, that's so well said. Yeah, it's just, it's about your goals, because I see this a lot working with clients. You're like, well, what if I did this? And what if I did that? Well, it's like, what do you want to do? What are your goals? Right. You know, is it cash flow? Is it just putting it like a long-term investment where you're going to have it accumulate over a period of time? Like, are you trying to replace your job? Like, what's kind of cool? Because some people might not want to replace their job, right? They like being a doctor. They like being a lawyer. They like being an engineer, but they're just looking for extra income on the side. Or, you know, or they actually are trying to leave their job. So it's important to really kind of dig into the goals and then use, you know, oil and gas, real estate, whole life insurance, just as tools to help them reach their goals. So Billy, it was a pleasure getting to know you, interviewing you. How can the listeners learn more about you and connect with you?
Yeah, man. So, and one of the things I didn't even say earlier, but if you are an accredited investor and this kind of sounds like something you want to at least start getting educated about, I would highly recommend that you go to firstgencp.com/paylesstax. I'll say it again, firstgencp.com/paylesstax. We'll send you out a little document. You can find out a little bit more. Also get you into our world. You can find out what I'm writing about on a weekly basis, things like that. I would also say for those of you who like podcasts, and very soon they're going to hear Sari on the Going Long podcast with Billy Keels. It's a podcast that's rated in the top 1.5% of podcasts globally. Feel free to subscribe, find out about what this guy who's living in Europe has built this lifestyle and investing exclusively back in the United States and helping other people get strategies that way would be great. And then also, I love connecting with people on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. So feel free to leave me a personalized invitation. Let me know to reconnect. We'll feel free to do just that. So Sari, thank you so much for the opportunity to share a bit more about my story with you and with your entire audience.
Thanks, Billy. It's a pleasure interviewing you and getting to know you. Looking forward to having you back on our podcast.
Thank you very much.
To learn more about what we do and how we can help you grow more wealth, please visit www.finassetprotection.com. That's F-I-N assetprotection.com. The topics presented in this podcast are for general information only and not for the purposes of providing legal, accounting, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult a professional who knows your specific situation.